Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, noise complaints still threatening live music. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Apple Music put its prices up.
Yes, if you get your streaming music goodness from the company they call Apple, you will... I don't know if this is every single country, actually, but certainly if you're in the UK or the US, because I checked both of those countries, you are now going to be paying an extra pound or dollar a month in order to access all of that music. That was confirmed by the people at Apple last week.
Yes, and it's also putting up its Apple TV Plus subscription price. And if you, like me, get all of that bundled in to an Apple Premier account or whatever it's called, where you get all of the Apple services together and you're feeling a bit smug, well, they're putting the price up on that too. So stop it.
Although interestingly, in the statement they put out confirming and justifying these price increases, the excuse for increasing the cost of music was different to the excuse for increasing the cost for TV. So on the TV side, technically it's Apple TV Plus, isn't it, that you pay for?
Yes.
Is Apple TV just the app and then the Plus?
Apple TV is just an app. Apple TV Plus is all of the TV shows that they make.
So on the TV side, they were basically saying, we haven't put up the prices since we launched that service. And when we launched it, there was hardly any content. And now there's loads of content. So you're getting loads more shows and programs. So therefore, you should pay more. While on the music side, they were basically saying the costs of licensing music have gone up or are going up. But crucially, with this extra pound or dollar a month that you're putting into the system, artists and songwriters will benefit from that because, of course, on the music side, it's all a rev share game. So if Apple is charging more money, then the music industry will get more money. Its percentage will be worth more, which ultimately means down the supply chain, artists and songwriters will benefit. And on that latter point, I mean, whether or not it was the labels insisting on these price increases, we don't know, although it is definitely true that a lot of people in the music industry, artists, songwriters, labels and publishers have been calling for these price increases, especially to that sort of $9.99 basic streaming package. There has been a lot of support for increasing that price in the music community for quite some time.
Yeah, because obviously it's been $9.99 across the board, all the services, pretty much since Spotify launched in, what, 2008? And so if you adjust for inflation over time, I mean, the price has really gone down, hasn't it? So because it's not changed at all. And that means that the money coming in is of less value to both the services and the rights holders, which is why the rights holders are pushing for increases. And I suppose there's been, it's quite a good price point, $9.99. I think that's why we've stuck there for so long. And there's been a reticence to move away from that. Whereas, I mean, people always point out that Netflix regularly puts its prices up. But the difference there is that Netflix and all the different TV streaming services offer different things. And Netflix has an offering that it feels that people will stick with if it puts its prices up. Whereas if all the music streaming services basically offer the same catalogue, which, you know, they pretty much do, if one puts its prices up, the fear is that everyone would just move on to one of the others. So, well, we'll see if that happens with Apple or if Apple has managed to convince people that it's worth sticking with, and also whether the other streaming services now follow suit, because I'm sure they all actually want to put their prices up. Spotify has experimented with putting prices up on some of its cheaper packages, like its family plan and things like that. And last week, Spotify CEO Daniel Ek did indicate that Spotify might follow Apple's lead and increase prices on its baseline subscription, the main subscription that it pulls people into. And then, I mean, once you've got, I suppose it's, the hurdle is doing it for the first time and not knowing what's going to happen. But if prices start going up and it's fine, then presumably we can expect that to happen on a semi-regular basis from now on.
Yeah, I would suspect so, because I guess you alluded to a couple of the potential issues for music streaming services there, partly the fact that everyone has the same catalogue, partly the fact that $9.99 in, you know, obviously it's not $9.99 everywhere, but certainly in the North American markets, the UK, and a lot of the sort of the European markets where euro are the currency, it has been $9.99, and mentally it does feel like that's the perfect price point. Going from $9.99 to $10.99, which is what Apple are doing, seems more significant than going from $10.99 to $11.99. So now they've done it. Maybe it won't be as big a deal down the line. Plus, yeah, in terms of will they lose customers, I suspect that they won't. I mean, the fact that we think Spotify are going to put up the prices anyway, then part of that is if you're an Apple subscriber, you could go to Spotify, save a pound a month, but probably by the end of the year, you would be on the same subscription price. And also, although every music streaming service basically offers you the same music, moving services is still a bit of a hassle. Yes, there are apps out there that will help you move playlists that you've set up in one platform to another platform. But even so, for saving a pound a month, it does seem like quite a lot of hassle. So I think not that many people will move from Apple. Also, I suppose Apple customers usually are not there because it's a bargain. That's not really why you go with Apple products or Apple services. But I think Apple will be fine, and I think Spotify will follow the lead. Yeah, and I agree. I think once we're past this initial increase in price, we've gone beyond the $9.99 price point, we've proven that you don't lose lots and lots of subscribers when you increase the prices. I think, as we have seen with Netflix type services over the years, at the very least, they will stay in line with inflation in the years ahead, and they will send you out emails updating you on those inflationary price increases every so often, which no one will read. No one will realise that their direct debits have gone up. And this whole price point thing will cease to be a big talking point. But yeah, as we say, for the music industry, it has been an increasing talking point in recent years that 14 years on, the value of that baseline subscriber has actually fallen quite significantly. And given that music streaming is a revenue share game, how much the music industry earns is totally dependent on what's coming in. So artists, songwriters, labels and publishers have been pushing these price increases for quite some time. Therefore, Apple's announcement was very well received in the music community. Spotify will be under increased pressure. It was interesting last week, Daniel Ek, who was talking to his investors, because it was part of the investor chat after publishing their quarterly financial report, he was kind of saying, oh, we'd love to increase our prices, but we need to talk to the labels about it. Whereas, as far as I can see, the labels have wanted a price increase for quite some time.
And yeah, the labels, I don't think they're going to say no.
The labels have definitely sort of generally talked about this, certainly off the record, as being a Spotify issue rather than a music industry issue. So I think we will start to see those price increases, which will mean, at the very least, the money coming in from streaming in the next few years hopefully will be keeping up with inflation. From the industry perspective, I guess from a music fan's perspective, everything is going up at the moment, isn't it? So on one level, what if everything's going up, who's surprised that their music subscription prices are going up? Although, given everything is going up, it's yet another price increase for everyone to deal with. So I guess the other question is, I don't think many Apple Music subscribers are going to jump ship to Spotify, but could we start to see particularly some of those more mainstream consumers who probably signed up to music streaming for the first time during lockdown, could we start to see some of them just cancel the subscription entirely given all the costs are going up? Who knows? But we're not here, actually, even though we've talked about this quite a lot already. We should stress this is not something we're talking about on this week's set list, because this is a podcast, and wherever you're listening to it, you get it for free.
Yes, even on Apple. Although, I don't know, maybe we could start charging for it. Should we start charging for it?
Let's start charging £100 an edition. I'm sure everyone would sign up. Definitely worth £100 per podcast, isn't it?
I reckon. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's come back to that. Later on, we're going to be discussing 5 seconds of Summer's feelings about winning the worst band prize at the NME Awards 3 years in a row. But first, Manchester music venue The Night and Day Cafe revealed last week that it is continuing to fight a noise abatement notice that was served against it by Manchester City Council last year. It says that the council is refusing to retract the notice, meaning that an appeal will likely have to go to court at the end of next month. And if the venue loses, its owners say, it will likely mean that it will have to close down altogether. In a statement, the venue explained, Manchester City Council refused to remove the noise abatement notice they served on us last November. Night and Day have appealed the notice. Despite explaining to the council's licensing department and council leaders that we have and continue to operate in the exact same manner as we have done previously and for the past 30 years, the council refused to remove the notice.
Yes, so as it said in that statement, we first became aware of this issue last November when Night and Day, the brilliant venue in Manchester's Northern Quarter, was first served with this noise abatement notice. As far as we understand, the notice from the council regarding noise coming out of that venue has been issued based on a single complaint from one person who lives in a residential property next to the venue. Yes, this is one of these very annoying stories that, for reasons we'll get into, doesn't come up quite as much now as it did a few years ago. But this is basically one of those stories where somebody chooses to buy a flat right next to an existing music venue, and then when they move in, start moaning that music venue has music playing at night and that it's too noisy. As far as we understand, what happened here is that the person who has made this complaint bought and moved into their property next to the Night and Day Cafe during the COVID lockdown, when obviously the venue was not operating. And then as soon as the venue reopened last summer and started staging gigs again, that's when the complaint was made that resulted in the noise abatement notice. Although it has to be said that the fact that this person moved into this flat during lockdown, when obviously there wasn't any music playing at the venue because the venue was closed. But, I mean, anyone who knows Manchester, and particularly the Northern Quarter of Manchester, where the Night and Day venue is based, I mean, there is absolutely no excuse for choosing to move into that part of Manchester, even during lockdown, and to then subsequently complain that there are lots of people on the street at night and there's music coming from the venue, because that is the bit of Manchester where all of the exciting nightlife type stuff happens. It's been like that for years. So yeah, a really annoying situation where you've got the new resident coming in, choosing a part of town which is an exciting part of town exactly because these venues and bars and cafes are there, and then as soon as people are using those bars and venues and cafes, moaning and causing licensing issues for the venue.
Yeah, and you mentioned that these kind of stories used to be a lot more commonplace. We used to report on things like this pretty regularly, and less so now. And that's down to a change of law in England that came in a few years ago, which was actually aimed at property developers rather than individuals making noise complaints, because actually generally this starts with property developers. So in 2018, the UK government introduced the Agent of Change principle into planning law in England as a result of a lot of campaigning on this issue. And what the Agent of Change does is it puts the onus on developers to identify and mitigate potential noise issues when they're redeveloping properties in an area with existing businesses already in place there. And the backstory to things like this usually comes down to property developers attracted to an area that's been made vibrant by things like live music. So commonly what we'd see in this kind of story would be that a music venue had opened up in a kind of derelict part of town where no one really wanted to be, and then the existence of a music venue there had attracted other businesses like bars and things like that, you know, built up a nightlife. And then once that area is cool, property developers see an opportunity and they move in and they start redeveloping other buildings into residential properties, but often without putting in any kind of protection for those residential properties against the nightlife that exists around them. And then once those properties have been sold off and people are living in them, the property developers are long gone, and all you're left with are some angry people who can't sleep, who make complaints about venues that were there in the first place. So that was what the agent of change principle was there to resolve, to make sure that developers were putting in proper soundproofing in these properties that they were redeveloping, so that we wouldn't get these disputes later in the day once it's too late to do anything much about them.
Now, actually, the backstory to this particular night and day saga does sort of follow the narrative you've just described, although, of course, we should remind ourselves that the Night and Day Cafe itself has been there for more than 30 years now, opening up in what was then a very rundown part of Manchester and helping to kickstart the revival of what we now call the Northern Quarter, where lots of great music and culture and nightlife happens. That said, the property where the complainant lives, as far as we're aware, was redeveloped more recently than that. So we do sort of have an issue that we've got some properties in that part of town redeveloped a few years ago, and that's where the complainant is now living. Although the redevelopment was long enough ago that it predates that change to planning rules in England that you just talked about, where the agent of change principle was put into the planning guidelines. That said, as it's been explained to us, Manchester City Council did basically put those agent of change rules into the planning permission that it granted to the property developer who redeveloped these residential properties next to Night and Day. So that was Manchester City Council being forward-looking, possibly recognising that this part of town was really important to Manchester culturally. Manchester, of course, is one of those cities that likes to talk up its status as a music city. So well done to Manchester City Council preempting the change to law across England and ensuring that the property developers, when they got their planning permission, had to do some stuff around checking about possible future noise issues and mitigating for those possible future noise issues. That was great, except the council then didn't enforce those restrictions in the planning obligations. As far as we can see, the developer ignored those planning restrictions. So we're now left in a situation where, even without the agent of change principle being in the rules across England, technically, all of these issues should have been anticipated by the developer. They were obliged to do that. The council had already set in motion the system to ensure that that happened, but it didn't happen. And now, the same Manchester City Council is taking this complaint from this new resident and causing issues for Night and Day that could ultimately result in the venue having to close.
Yeah, so in its statement last week, Night and Day said, after receiving a copy of the Manchester City Council planning file for the redevelopment where the complainant lives, we were shocked and appalled to find that a crucial acoustic report had not been provided, nor acoustic work completed to the development before it was occupied. This was a condition of the planning consent for conversion of the building next door to ensure that residents were not disturbed by noise, specifically from pre-existing entertainment businesses. It went on to say that Night and Day's owners have brought all this to the attention of council leaders and feel strongly that Night and Day has been mistreated and that this is the council's problem to resolve, but the local authority refuses to retract the notice nonetheless. We believe, the statement goes on, there have been no further noise complaints that have arisen during the notice period. Despite this, Manchester City Council refuse to remove the notice and continue to place the onus on Night and Day to resolve.
But, of course, I think many people, I would even go as far as to say most people would agree that this is a problem which not only should Night and Day not have to resolve, it's really hard for them to do so because these residential properties have been redeveloped, people are living in them now, the soundproofing that should have been there isn't there. What is Night and Day to do? The problem here is that the council, back when they were giving planning permission, correctly identified a future problem, correctly put in place the measures to stop the problem from becoming a problem, then didn't monitor the situation, didn't enforce those obligations, and the developer got away without doing what they should have done, and they are now well and truly out of the picture. As you mentioned earlier, if the council does not remove this abatement notice, we're hoping that possibly with mounting opposition in Manchester and beyond, they might. But if they do not, all of this is going to head to court next month. And Night and Day were very clear last week. If our appeal in court is unsuccessful, then this puts us at immediate risk of prosecution in the event of another noise complaint. For us to comply with the requirements of the notice would effectively ruin Night and Day as a live music venue, which would likely mean the closure of the venue altogether.
Now, Manchester City Council has also issued a statement on this and is defending itself. It said, "The council is and remains supportive of the music scene in Manchester, which Night and Day has championed, but we have to comply with our duties in respect of statutory noise nuisance. It is important to note that the source of complaints regarding this venue relate to very loud music played into the early hours of the morning and not live band performances. The council is not seeking to close down the venue, and we want to work with the venue to address the noise, for example, through suitable acoustic measures."
Though it's interesting, isn't it, that what the council is not saying there is, yeah, we really screwed up a few years ago.
Yeah.
This is a mess that is our making, and we are going to do something to address it, and we will pay for whatever needs to happen to address these issues. Certainly, Manchester City Council not only is facing a legal challenge here, obviously, as we've said, if a resolution is not reached in the next couple of weeks, it will end up in court. But there is also a mounting PR challenge for the City Council, because I think it's fair to say that the Manchester music community and well beyond Manchester are pretty outraged that this is happening. We thought we put stories like this behind us, and it is all the more frustrating given what we know about what should have happened when this property was redeveloped and the council dropped the ball and didn't make that happen. So a petition was actually launched last year when the noise abatement notice was first filed. It gained 50,000 signatures in less than 24 hours, and the venue is now hoping to get it up to 150,000. As we record this podcast, it's just under 87,000. And I think we are going to see an ever increasing number of musicians from Manchester and across the UK, and it wouldn't surprise me if elsewhere in the world as well, coming out in support of Night and Day, as I say, particularly because of this backstory that is basically Manchester City Council's fault. The Music Venue Trust also put out a pretty firm statement last week in support of Night and Day.
Yeah, it said, "The refusal by Manchester City Council to overturn the noise abatement notice issued to the iconic music venue, Night and Day Cafe, presents a very simple, clear, understandable and practical example for the UK's music community. Either Manchester wants to be the proud home of British music or it doesn't. With all respect to everyone in the city leadership, no amount of music boards, commissions, supportive statements or well-intentioned political positions will change the reality. Either Manchester City Council act to save the Night and Day Cafe, or they should just take down the billboards, switch off the marketing, drop the pretense and prepare to close up shop on music. If Manchester cannot protect the Night and Day Cafe, it isn't a music city."
So MVT alluding there to what we mentioned earlier, the fact that Manchester does like to talk up its music city credentials, and it's been doing a lot of work to present itself as this very music-friendly city in recent years. There is some sort of politics within the city, because the mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, is a big supporter of the music industry and the music community and likes to talk about that support. But his local authority for Greater Manchester is different to Manchester City Council, so we've got different institutions within that part of the country probably battling with each other. It also wouldn't surprise me if within Manchester City Council itself, you've got different departments, because obviously it's the planning department that dropped the ball in terms of getting the soundproofing and the noise issues addressed back when these residential properties were being redeveloped. Meanwhile, it'd be a different department dealing with the noise abatement notice and having to deal with the complaints from the public. Meanwhile, you'll have the PR department struggling as well. So it will be really interesting to see what happens. We all have our fingers crossed that a solution, a council-led solution, can be found and can be found quite soon. And obviously, in terms of bigger picture, interesting question is, well, what does this tell us about venues elsewhere in England in terms of the agent of change principle that was introduced, as we say? Obviously, this planning application was before that England-wide regulation. So on one level, it's not actually testing the new regime. That said, as we say, City Council did voluntarily put those obligations into the planning and then ignored them and failed to enforce them. So could we have a situation where councils who are following the government-led agent of change principle in the planning guidelines put these obligations into other planning permission documents in other cities where people are redeveloping buildings into residential properties next to venues and then not properly enforce those restrictions and have another screw up like we have in Manchester? Or maybe the fact that the agent of change principle is now properly in planning guidelines, it's not something that just councils are doing on an ad hoc basis, maybe that has made it much more part of the planning regime. So perhaps had this all happened after 2018, when agent of change was put into the guidelines, maybe the council would have done a better job of enforcing those rules and we wouldn't now be in the mess that we're in. So it's hard to know whether or not this is suggesting that just having agent of change in the guidelines is not enough, or maybe the fact it's now in the guidelines means that the councils of the country will be less likely to insist on things and then completely ignore them and screw everything up. So both interesting to watch what happens in Manchester in the weeks ahead, and of course a reminder of the bigger debate around agent of change and ensuring that these sorts of things don't happen, so that the venues that make a part of a city cool then get kicked out because of complaints by the people who only moved there because the venue made it cool.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, 5 Seconds of Summer have spoken about how winning the worst band prize at the Enemy Awards 3 years in a row affected them as people and as a band. They said this in an interview with The Enemy, weirdly, while they're promoting their 5th album, which clearly The Enemy is somewhat excited about, excited enough to give them a big interview and ask them about being the worst band in the world. And I suppose, I mean, if you don't know 5 Seconds of Summer, where have you been? But they are a pop rock band from Australia. They released their first album in 2014, so they're pretty well established. I don't think this accolade hurt them too much. But in this interview, their drummer, Ashton Irwin, said, "You called us the worst band, and that affects the guy. That guy at 28 doesn't give a fuck, and I actually think it's awesome. But when you're 17 and 18, you go, I'm in the worst band, what? And it's like, what do you mean? What does that mean to me? What did I do wrong?" That's just a relative example of how things can be said about the character of the band that really do affect the stability of the whole thing.
So that was The Enemy told in that interview. And also, anyone else who was following The Enemy Awards back in the mid-2010s when 5 Seconds of Summer were declared worst band 3 years running, anyone else who smiled at that? I suppose you've mentioned a bit of background on 5 Seconds of Summer. Some of our listeners outside the UK might not be that familiar with the Enemy Awards. Enemy, I'm sure you do know. Enemy Awards has been the annual awards event that the magazine has run for many, many, many years. And old people listening to Setlist may remember back in the 1990s, and this is relevant, this is not just me getting nostalgic, this is relevant to this story, I promise you. Back in the 1990s, I guess it was a period when the Brit Awards, so the big UK record industry annual awards, the official awards run by the industry, the Brit Awards were seen as being very corporate, but in a way that, whereas in the 80s you sort of sensed that the Brit Awards didn't care that they were a big corporate event, in the 90s, with the rise of Britpop and Cool Britannia, the Brit Awards were trying to reposition themselves as being a little bit more cool and in the main failing.
Yeah.
And so the Enemy Awards was almost the sort of reaction to that. And for a while they called themselves the Brats, didn't they?
Yeah.
And the idea was, okay, the corporate industry over there with their sponsors and their TV broadcast, they're trying to be cool and failing, and we're the cool people, we know all the cool bands, we're the fun, reactionary, big piss-up that pretends to be an award show. And it was in that context that, alongside Best Album, Best Artist, etc., they did have a few sarcastic, jokey categories, which were the worst ... and they also had the Villain of the Year prize. And I guess that was where this came from. But then, as the 2000s and the 2010s progressed, and I guess people became a little less judgmental about the Brits. Meanwhile, the NME Awards, bearing in mind this was the period where, as a magazine, it became really hard to make any money selling a magazine, and the way to make money was to sell big sponsorship on your awards events. So the NME Awards themselves became a little bit bigger and a little bit more corporate in a way. And I guess by the mid-2010s, the fact that this quite slick award show that the NME ran every year with a big corporate sponsor still had these worst categories kind of started to become a little bit weird, which is why they ultimately dropped it. So actually, 5 Seconds of Summer were the last ever winners of the Worst Band Award, which I think means that they are the worst band forever.
Yes, in perpetuity. They will never live that down. They will be that for the rest of time. No going back. But yeah, you mentioned there were other worst awards. There was the Worst Album Award and the Worst Dressed Award, which latterly was renamed Least Stylish. And also, as you mentioned, the Villain of the Year Award, which went alongside the Hero of the Year Award. And as you say, this is all coming from when the NME Awards was trying to be more anti-establishment. Although, I mean, they really pinched the idea from the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, didn't they? Which was the big pop awards of Smash Hits magazine, which everyone misses. But as you say, over time, as the NME Awards became more of an established, not so much corporate, but definitely slicker event with big sponsorship, those awards did look a bit odd. And also, they always went to really easy targets. It wasn't a huge amount of fun seeing just people who a reader of the NME wouldn't like be given this stupid award for what purpose? Just to go like, yeah, we don't like that person who the NME wouldn't cover anyway. I think Justin Bieber won quite a lot of those prizes over the years. And yeah, they did increasingly look quite odd. And the Worst Album and Least Stylish Awards were dropped first. The Worst Band one carried on until 2017 and then was ditched. They also dropped the Villain of the Year prize, but they brought that back for this year's ceremony. It went to Jacob Rees-Mogg. Which is, I mean, that's it. If you look down the list of award winners over the years, the Villain of the Year used to go to someone just, you know, pointless. You know, Harry Styles won it. And in more recent times, it's gone to divisive political figures. So Jacob Rees-Mogg, I think, has possibly won it more than once. Piers Morgan's won it. And I think it's you can sort of track the disillusionment of the UK's youth over time, going from just going like, yeah, don't like Harry Styles, to I'm fed up with the politics of this country. So that's sort of an interesting thing to look at. But I guess the point that we're trying to get to is, should you be going around giving out prizes, telling people that they're the worst at something?
Yeah, and I suppose, although the main reason why these awards were phased out was because the NME moved on, the NME Awards moved on, and they just sort of fell out of place. There's also that whole thing that it does feel like in the last 10 years, media, and particularly music media rather than sort of tabloid newspapers, music media sort of laying in to the biggest pop stars of the day has sort of felt like something that maybe we shouldn't be doing as much. And that's kind of, I am actually saying we there. Because obviously, yes. with our CMU Daily Bulletin, what we were traditionally known for, and are still known for to an extent, is that we were quite sarcastic. And within our sarcasm, often we were taking aim at the sort of the more corporate end of the music industry and the big corporate figures within the business, and particularly when brands were putting out nonsense statements around their sponsorship deals and stuff like that. But back in the day, we were also quite sarcastic and harsh about whoever the biggest pop stars of the moment were, because in the 2000s, when the CMU Daily first launched and gained momentum, well, it kind of seemed funny, and our readers used to tell us that they really liked it. Whereas I think in more recent years, although we're still sarcastic from time to time, quite often with the pop stars. I don't know, I think it's because in the social media age, you see all of the sort of terrible trolling and hate they have to deal with on the social networks. And whereas perhaps back in the 2000s, when artists were kind of protected from all of that, it was like, well, you're a big pop star, you're cashing in, you're making a load of money, so we're going to mock you, and that's just part of being a pop star. Whereas I think now, it's like, oh my God, they're taking so much heat on the social networks and dealing with so much shit on the social networks. Why would we want to add to that? So I think lots of music media, including CMU, we're not as sarcastic and harsh about whoever the big sort of easy target pop stars are of the moment. I mean, that does mean, well, the other week, I don't know why, a Simon Amstel era Nevermind the Buzzcocks clip appeared in my YouTube feed. And I watched it, and I think anyone who's been a long time reader of CMU will know we were big fans of like, you know, Pop World in the early 2000s and Nevermind the Buzzcocks, which were entirely built on being sarcastic and a little bit rude to pop stars. And it was funny and entertaining. But here we are in the 2020s, and it kind of doesn't feel right anymore, does it?
No, it's funny. Well, I think when we were writing those things, I was thinking of our readers who I knew liked that sort of thing. I was never thinking that the pop star themselves would see that. They were sort of an abstract thing over there who would never get back to them. It doesn't matter what I say, really, which is possibly true. I mean, certainly in terms of the big pop stars, they're not going to read CMU. But increasingly, I mean, as social media has blown up, aside from the fact that there's people being horrible to pop stars 24 hours a day, and that's something to deal with, these things do get tweeted to them, and they're saying, like, what do you think of this being said about you? And it's like, oh, well, now I feel a bit bad about it. And, you know, there are things, I mean, there are lots of things I wrote that were quite rude about people that I would still stand by, but there are things that I feel quite bad about now. So yeah, maybe it's partly just we got older. But yeah, there are things that make me slightly uncomfortable now that didn't at the time, because I just thought that's a funny thing to say. So, but yeah, times change, don't they? Times have moved on. And well, this 5 seconds of summer interview is an interesting example of that, because he's saying, you know, now they're older, they've been around a long time, they're clearly very successful, and it doesn't bother them anymore. But yeah, if you're a teenager and the NME is saying you're the worst band in the world 3 years in a row, that is going to have quite an effect on you. And yeah, you got to think about those things, haven't you?
I guess the flip side, I mean, I mentioned like a Pop World back in the day and the Simon Amstel era, Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and they were very sarcastic and very harsh to artists. And I mean, whereas we were doing it sort of in a bulletin, which most of those artists were never going to read, they were doing it to the artist's face. Now, I'm not sure which is worse, whether doing it to the artist's face is worse or whether doing it behind their backs is worse. I don't know. But the flip side of that was with those programs, the artists that sort of embraced it and joked back, you then really rated and respected, even if you had no interest in their music. There were certain pop stars where it's like, okay, your music, it's not for me, but do you know what? I'm not going to slag you off because you responded to that really well. You were really funny. And I mean, obviously, where you're being written about in, you know, on websites and in daily bulletins and things like that, you're not going to respond. You're not given an opportunity to respond. That said, you know, there are some artists who would, once social media became a thing, respond to those, not in an angry way, but in a funny way. And again, even if you don't like their music, you sort of rate them. So I think that there was a bit of a positive side. I'm not saying that that necessarily justifies it. But I mean, obviously, a prime example there is James Blunt, somebody who had a lot of backlash back in the 2000s when he became the biggest artist in the UK, and lots of people who don't like his music because it's a very specific kind of music. I mean, a very successful kind of music back in the day, but a lot of people didn't like it. But of course, since he's become this star on Twitter, lots of people who don't really have any time for his music nevertheless sort of like him because he is quite funny on Twitter. And he also won one of the worst awards at the NME. I think it was the worst album that he was presented with, but not presented with, because actually he had quite a good response to it. Again, I think in an interview of the NME where he brought it up.
Yes, you're right. He won that worst album award in 2006, but never received the trophy. I guess he didn't turn up to collect it. And I think people have turned up to collect those awards in the past, you know, kind of recognising the humour in it and sort of owning the backlash against them. But he didn't turn up to the ceremony and then wasn't sent the trophy. And he said in this interview with the Enemy in 2019, "It's just really mean to get an award and not be sent it. I'd put it in pride of place right above my bed so I could look up at it and see it every day. That would be the best award in the world to have."
So maybe my assumption is that 5 Seconds of Summer never actually received their 3 trophies either. So maybe that's how Enemy can now make good on it by actually sending them the trophies.
If you're going to have those awards, you have to have the guts to actually send them to the people who win them. You can't just, you know, have it happen on the night and hope they don't notice. You've got to follow through with it, despite everything I previously said.
So if anyone from Enemy is listening, do the right thing and send 5 Seconds of Summer the 3 worst band trophies they presumably never received. After all, the drummer did say that although he was a bit stressed about it back in the day, he now actually finds it quite funny and quite awesome. So maybe he, like James Blunt, wouldn't mind having those trophies on his mantelpiece at home.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go to the show notes in your podcast player or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you're not doing that already. Rate and review the show. Maybe some podcasts ask you to say something other than just a review, don't they? So maybe you could put a review up on iTunes or whatever and tell us who the worst band in the world is. And if you don't want to do that publicly, you could just email us and tell us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.